Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Dr. Zed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Miller specializes in pain and palliative care. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, we look at current trends in cancer research with Dr. Vincent DeVita, the former director of the National Cancer Institute.
Vince, I have to say, for years during my training, my mentors would always refer back to the beginning of combination chemotherapy and really some of the most amazing work that you did back in the 60s at the National Cancer Institute. So it really is the source of legend among oncologists. Can you tell us about that adventure of what happened in the 60s with your work?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because we did this with great trepidation. Nowadays, combination chemotherapy is given in the outpatient department everywhere in every way you can imagine. In those days, it was considered very risky business, and we actually put the first few patients in the early laminar airflow rooms because we were worried about what was going to happen to them. But I think what the most important part of those experiments that we were doing in those days was that when I came into the field, the lore was chemotherapy was toxic. It probably didn't help anybody, and therefore, you know, why bother to give it? The word cure never crept into the language. And the group that I landed with at the Cancer Institute, Tom Fry and Jay Freireich, were a different mind. They wanted to set out to prove that you could cure cancer with drugs. And so they were working in leukemia. We started the work in Hodgkin's disease, and we followed a lot of the experiments of a man named Howard Skipper, who was doing the same sort of things in mice. He was a mathematician turned biologist. Yes. And he in 1964, reported the first cure of a mouse leukemia. And around that time, we were using the same principles to treat childhood leukemia and Hodgkin's disease. And ultimately, by 1970, it was clear that a significant fraction in the case of Hodgkin's disease patients were cured by combination chemotherapy when they had an advanced cancer. And that's the experiment that was really the heart of everything that we were doing. It was very exciting to see because, you know, it was quite in contrast to what the beliefs were at that time.
It's interesting because back then, and obviously being a product of the National Cancer Institute myself, having trained there under Dr. DeVita, you know, I think the National Cancer Institute was viewed as really the mecca, the center of the universe for medical oncology, cancer chemotherapy, and not just for leukemia, lymphoma, but really for a lot of the other solid tumors.
Yeah, well, you know, it's to some degree they have the same freedom that we had in those days. But in those days, we could do things nobody else could do. First of all, we had stable financial support. Second is we could admit patients to the clinical center from anywhere and keep them there for as long as we wanted to study them, something you can't do anywhere nowadays. Probably you can in the clinical center to some degree. So you really were limited by your ideas, where in the current research environment, you're limited by the financial resources and other resources that are at your disposal as much as by your idea. You can have a good idea. You may not be able to get the resources to carry it out. And the clinical center was, you know, the mecca for working and translating your ideas into practice.
Vince, in the early 60s, I mean, if someone came to you with Hodgkin's disease, what would they have been treated with? And then what happened later on? And what kind of changes did you see in terms of treatment outcome?
Yeah, well, there was a funny meeting that was chaired by Tom Fry when we did our first study, which was called MOMP, M-O-M-P, because one of the drugs was methotrexate at the time. We then switched it to procarbazine. But we were going around the table. I was a youngster, and Tom wanted me to tell everybody what I was doing. But he was very clever because the environment was a little bit hostile. So he went around the table and said, "What are you doing?" And everybody went around. And what everybody was doing was testing one alkylating agent compared to another alkylating agent. It was, you know, that was the drug. I mean, you gave him chlorambucil, or you gave him the newer drug, Cytoxan, and there was no effort to say, can we eradicate the disease? It was more which alkylating agent will be easier to use. And then I got up and presented the combination, and a very famous oncologist now passed away, who remained a good friend of mine, but he raised his hand. He turned visibly white and raised his hand to me and said, now he is this famous professor, and here I'm a young whippersnapper. And he said, Dr. DeVita, do your patients speak to you after you do this to them? And I was a bit shaken. Tom smoothed it all out. Years later, I was invited to his institution to give grand rounds, and I started out by saying, do you remember Dr. Rundle's he was the developer, by the way, of chlorambucil. Mm-hmm. I said, do you remember you asked me, do my patients speak to me after I do this? And I said, yes, for a lot longer. So it actually was assimilated very quickly. It was one of the first tools where you could actually offer patients a cure. The full assimilation of combination chemotherapy into the medical environment took 11 years. It was a very wonderful paper that came out and looked at the diffusion into practice. It was an initial very big blip, and then gradually it went to virtually every patient with Hodgkin's disease who had advanced disease. And then what happened and what has happened still is the conversion of from radiotherapy for earlier stages to chemotherapy for earlier stages. And we're now in a bit of turmoil about whether or not you need radiotherapy and whether you use both in combination. That's really the focus of most of the studies.
But again, I think that's really the model that we've followed, not only for Hodgkin's lymphoma or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but for all other solid tumors, other cancers.
It was designed, and again, credit to Dr. Skipper, who just recently passed away. It was designed based on, first of all, using drugs that worked in combination, and the other was to schedule them around the growth of the bone marrow. So we actually did studies in rodents on their bone marrow. We did studies in humans on their bone marrow. We calculated the interval we could safely give combination chemotherapy. We didn't have GCSF and these factors that used to protect the bone marrow in those days. So we had to schedule around the most vulnerable organ, which is the bone marrow. And it turned out for many years it was a very effective schedule for any combination program. And that's – we actually developed the CMF program for breast cancer on the same principles. And my friend Gianni Buonadonna in Italy – tested it in breast cancer. It was the first really effective adjuvant program in breast cancer as well. So it was a very exciting time and a very exciting environment, and it captured all of us. I think those of you who went through the National Cancer Institute, I think you could feel the electric environment. We were aiming at something different than other people were aiming at, and we had the means to do it, and we did it.
Along those lines, what are some of the basic principles that you learned then, that you established then, that we still use now in terms of combinations and the efficacy and side effects?
Yeah, well, I tell you, there's one that I really think is very important, and that is that it, with rare exceptions, combination chemotherapy is required for any tumor that is cured by chemotherapy. And so you say to yourself, well, with all the new therapies like Dr. Foss and her biologic therapies and with the targeted therapies, is this true still? And I think the answer is yes. It turns out that except for a very few tumors, most of the molecular targets in tumors like cancer of the pancreas and colon, there are multiple targets in any single tumor. And my guess, and this is purely my opinion, is that you're going to have to block more than one target, no matter what you use. And if you're using cytotoxic chemicals, that's one thing. If you're using targeted, you're probably still going to have to do the same thing. And we're going to have to learn how to use kinase inhibitors, monoclonal antibodies, and cytotoxic drugs in the most effective way to destroy the cancer cell. And I would guess that combination chemotherapy is with us to stay, at least for the foreseeable future. That's a lesson that I've learned. The other lesson that I learned that I think is you have to be careful, and when I first came to Yale, I told the faculty, I said, I don't really want anybody to be using MOP. I mean, I'm not promoting MOP. My great fear is that we set in motion something and then people can't get off the track, that if this is old-fashioned and you shouldn't be using it and you shouldn't be approaching it this way, or if I'm wrong about combination chemotherapy, and I've been wrong before, that you should not pin people down to the old ways. You have to be able to change. And I always think of the famous Hopkins surgeon, Holstead, who developed the radical mastectomy, which stayed around for 75 years. I have the feeling that if William Holstead had lived, he would have been the first to change, from the radical mastectomy to something else. But his disciples just kept it like it was a religion, and it was a very difficult transition to go from the radical mastectomy to other things that are much more effective. I don't want to be the person who's responsible for pinning people down to old-fashioned ways.
Vince, back in 1971, President Nixon signed the National Cancer Act, which I think many view as really kind of a landmark act. Maybe you could tell our listeners out there, you know, what was that all about? You obviously played a key role in that, and really what was the importance of that National Cancer Act?
Yeah, it was a very unique experiment, really. And what you just were talking about had played a role in this, because what happened was up until the 1970s, we had surgery and we had radiotherapy. The missing link was apparent when all the results from surgery and radiotherapy had flattened out, that it must be that cells are getting outside of the field and you needed something that you could give to the patient that would treat the cells that had escaped from the primary site. And when we were able to show you could cure Hodgkin's disease and childhood leukemia, Mary Lasker, who is a philanthropist who was responsible for many health initiatives, including the high blood pressure program that saved many people from strokes and so on, saw that and said, wow, now we've got critical mass and it's time to start a war on cancer. And she put a lot of pressure on all her friends in politics, and the war on cancer was initiated. And it was an effort that was unique in its time. And I think what it did was pour an enormous amount of resources into the cancer program and into the NIH. The NIH budget in general rose as the Cancer Institute budget rose, and it laid out a blueprint for what we should do, what we needed to do to eradicate cancer. It's a very interesting document, by the way, to read. It's one of those documents that is extremely wise. You wonder how prescient these people were when they wrote it. They used the phrase "insofar as feasible," very often, because they knew that we didn't have the resources to do some of the things they wanted to do, but they anticipated we would, and therefore we should do the following things insofar as feasible. When I became director in 1980, then I looked at the Cancer Act, and a lot of the insofar as feasibles had become feasible, and we began to implement and frame the Cancer Institute in a way that it could approach the mission of the Cancer Act.
How do you think we're collectively doing as you look back on that blueprint that was laid out?
Yeah. Well, I'm asked that question a lot, and I think, you see lots of articles saying war on cancer failed and so forth. And you have to ask people what their criteria for success is, okay? If your criteria for success is no one dies of cancer, then the cancer war failed. If your criteria for success is to look at the mandate of the Act was very clear. It's written right in front of the Act. It says to support research and the application of the results of research to reduce the incidence of mortality and morbidity from cancer. That's very plain. It doesn't say tomorrow. It doesn't say 10 years from now. It just says to support research and the applications of research. Now, that was new at the NIH. NIH never supported applications of research to reduce incidence, morbidity, and mortality from cancer. In 1990, the incidence of cancer began to drop. In 1990, the mortality from cancer began to drop, and morbidity of cancer is far less. If you look at breast cancer, in 1970, the women got a radical mastectomy, postoperative radiation therapy, big swollen arms. Their survival didn't change one iota, and it was a very, very morbid treatment. While any woman diagnosed today with breast cancer views the treatment as a very difficult exercise, it is so much better when you get a lumpectomy, radiation therapy, preserve the cosmetic effect, get chemotherapy that doesn't cause nausea and vomiting, and have national mortality from breast cancer falling as it is. So I think the mandate has been fulfilled. The timing of that fulfillment has been what has been the critical issue. It takes time. There was a lot of flurry about doing this by the bicentennial, which was not possible in anybody's mind because, the labs weren't even set up from the cancer funds by the bicentennial.
It's interesting. I think we're now beginning to see the fruits of all the hard work and labor that have been going on really over the last 20, 30 years trying to understand the molecular biology, the underlying genetics of cancer, and now we have identified all these interesting targets.
Well, again, one of the nice things about getting older is you can look back and see things that seem so incongruous. In 1983, the Cancer Institute was 23% of the NIH budget. And we were supporting 55% of all the molecular biology research in the country and most in the world. And I was actually warned that we were putting too much emphasis on molecular biology. Now, of course, now that we know the big payoff of the investment in molecular biology, that would seem silly. But in those days, people worried. You were weighting the institute's resources in favor of one area that would perhaps not pay off. And I think the molecular revolution in medicine came from the cancer war. It spilled over into all the other areas of medicine. And the good news is the best is yet to come. The fulfillment of the mandate is largely from the 15% of the dollars that went into the clinical programs and the combination chemotherapy, making them more widely available, developing new drugs. The 85% that went into the laboratory gave us the molecular revolution, which is just now hitting the clinic. You know, Gleevec for chronic myelocytic leukemia, monoclonal antibodies, is just coming along, and it's going to be the most exciting next 10 years, I think, in the history of the Cancer Institute.
Well, we'd like to remind you to email your questions to us and Dr. Vince DeVita at Yale at canceranswers@yale.edu. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more information about cancer treatment with Dr. Vincent DeVita from the Yale Cancer Center.
Over 170,000 Americans will be diagnosed with lung cancer this year, and more than 85% of these diagnoses are related to smoking. The important thing to understand is that quitting, even after decades of use, can significantly reduce your chance of developing lung cancer. Each day, patients with lung cancer are surviving, though, thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care, and new treatment options are giving lung cancer survivors new hope. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for lung cancer, and patients enrolled in these trials are given access to medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and Dr. Vincent DeVita, discussing trends in cancer treatment. Vince, I want to ask you about a related but different topic, which is, I mean, we've had such wonderful advances here in the United States. What is the status of oncology worldwide, both in the in the third world and in other parts of the world?
Yeah, that's interesting because I saw an article in the New York Times not too long ago suggesting that our healthcare system is not as good as people think it is, and that cancer care here, is suffering. And the fact of the matter is, our cancer care, I think, is unsurpassed in the world. I mean, people all over the world come here for cancer therapy. And a lot of the other countries have not invested the same way we have. They've benefited from what has been discovered here, but they don't always implement it. I just noticed, and in interest of full disclosure, I'm not on the board of the company of ImClone anymore, but I was. But the drug Erbitux, which ImClone makes, is a drug that has produced the first data showing improvement in survival in head and neck cancer in 30 years. And it's been approved by the FDA here and is being used but in head and neck cancer quite vigorously here. In Great Britain, the drug is not approved for use. They decided not to use it. It was too expensive. So you have a situation where you have a drug that clearly helps a category of patients. And the patients, if they want it, have to go somewhere else. They have to either go to the European continent where it is approved or come to the United States. And that's because it's a form of rationing because of their healthcare system. So I think we are in better shape than elsewhere. And if you look at the mortality rates, say in Great Britain, which is our closest cousin, and compare them to the United States, we are way ahead in terms of survival and mortality rates in the cancer. And I think for obvious reasons. So we should be very proud of our system. We need to fix the system to make it easier to navigate. But I think for the large part, our companies have developed drugs very vigorously and continue to do that. And we have better care.
I'm just curious, what are your thoughts about the socialized nature of medicine that obviously is practiced in Europe and Asia? I know some of my colleagues in France, Italy, and the UK are very limited by what types of novel biologic target therapies they can offer to their patients because the fact that everything is nationalized.
Yeah. Well, I think that's just exactly the point. The decision to made not to say then Erbitux was not the only drug. I don't think Avastin, if it was, if maybe it's approved now, but it wasn't right away. I think the decision not to approve these things is made by a bureaucrat who is looking at the budget as opposed to a doctor who's looking at the patient. You have a patient with head and neck cancer who has the type that mortality is reduced using Erbitux and radiotherapy, and you can't give it. That's a terrible thing. It wouldn't happen in this country. I mean, we can find ways to do it. And I think, therefore, you know, a system, a nationalized health system, has potential limitations. I'm really not in favor of that. I'm in favor of improving the system, but I'm not in favor of nationalized health care.
Vince, I want to go back to 1993 and when you became director of the Yale Cancer Center. But what are some of the challenges that you faced at Yale at the time? What were some of the issues that were being faced nationally? Yeah. In cancer.
Well, before I left the Cancer Institute, you know, part of the mandate was to build cancer centers to help carry out the mandate of the Cancer Act. And so before I left, we looked at cancer centers and decided that we needed to tighten up on the guidelines so that institutions that were cancer centers would fulfill certain responsibilities uniformly across the country. And then I left and took 5 years to implement those. And when I left Memorial Sloan Kettering and came to Yale, we were one of the first two cancer centers having to live up to the new guidelines. Mm-hmm. So my job when I got here was to make sure the cancer center was up to speed in those guidelines and to restructure it. And it was the first site visit, it was pretty tough. And I remember one of the site visitors when I said, you know, it's ironic that here I am having to live up to the guidelines that I set in motion. And he sort of in a stage whisper said, poetic justice. So I had a tough job and to change things. Institutions like Yale, you know, look very carefully before they make changes in the institution. And so it was structurally a lot of things we had to do, especially to try to get the clinical trials program functional. It's really remarkably good now, thanks to people like Ed and Rick Edelson. But I think it needed a little bit of work at that time, and I spent a lot of time doing that.
It is interesting, though, that I think the mandate now, and we actually underwent a recent site visit by the National Cancer Institute, is on clinical translational research, yeah. Translating ideas from the laboratories into the clinic, which really I think was the essence and the spirit of what was taking place at the NCI.
That's exactly.
30
the
years
the
ago.
Application of the results of research, which is something that scientists don't always pay attention to. They do now more than ever. But, you know, Yale has always had strong science. And the image that the hard part is the strong science is not correct. The hard part is the application of the science. It is extremely difficult to set up programs that translate laboratory work into the clinical practice. And that's every center in the country has struggled with ways of doing that. Some centers have done better than others, but some of the ones that have done better don't have much science to translate. We're in the unique position, I think, of having an extremely strong science base and now matching it with a program that can apply the results of that science, which is really, in this day and age, with the molecular revolution roaring down at us, this is where you want to be.
So what are the barriers between the bench and the bedside, between the lab and clinical care? What are some of the things that stop us?
There are a lot of things that you wouldn't normally think about. I think, for example, the Food and Drug Administration, if you just look at it globally, not from, say, Yale's perspective, look at it globally, the ability to develop drugs is very much dependent upon how flexible the Food and Drug Administration is. The Food and Drug Administration is not a particularly flexible organization, and I think they have a tremendously difficult job, but I think they need to look at how they handle cancer relative to, say, arthritis. I mean, the patients with arthritis have a different kind of disease that they live very long time, and testing drugs in arthritis has a different dimension to it. When test drugs in patients with advanced cancer, which is where we're forced to start, you're dealing with people who have a very limited lifespan, and I think we're much too restrictive in terms of access to drugs. And then the current environment in general is a very heavily regulated environment that is not conducive to getting an idea and running with it. You get an idea, you've got tons of paperwork and things like that. Now, it's necessary to some degree, but I think we need to continually examine it to let the science and the clinical science flourish.
And I would say probably another challenge, as Dr. Edelson and I are kind of dealing with this now on a daily basis, is funding and resources. And I think it's important for people out there listening to understand it's quite costly to be able to take the best ideas from the laboratory and bring them into the clinic and go back and forth. And unfortunately, you know, with funding from federal sources, from the National Cancer Institute, being limited. It's not so easy.
That's true. I mean, it takes $25,000 a patient to do a clinical trial. That's a substantial part of that is money that is required by you and your people to do a clinical trial at Yale. It may not be the entire $25,000. Some of it's by the drug company, but I would say anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000 per patient. Now, if you have to do a study on 100 patients or 1,000 patients, you just do the math. You're spending a lot of money on, and there are very few mechanisms at the NIH for supporting that kind of research, and philanthropy is very key. I mean, it's because you have the flexibility with philanthropy to be able to move the funds in the way you think is appropriate. But you don't have that with the federal government. It's a very rigid funding system.
Vince, I think most of us in our offices have your book, Cancer Principles and Practices of Oncology, which I now understand you've just finished the 8th edition. Well, what are some of the latest updates and focus of this edition?
Yeah, the 8th edition will be out this coming December. So I can't believe it. I sort of meter my life in editions of the book. it's been a joy because you can see the whole feel reflected in the content of the book. And again, as you might expect, the molecular revolution is very heavily reflected in the book. We have every disease chapter has before it, the chapter we have a chapter on the molecular biology of that disease. And then we have the front section of the book, which is the basic science part of it, has completely changed. I mean, it's amazing to look at it. It's amazing to go back and look at the first edition and then look at the same subject matter in the 8th edition. It's just like night and day. The other thing that we've done is we have a journal that called The Cancer Journal. We have renamed it, and it's been taken over by the publisher of the book. It's called The Cancer Journal, The Journal of Principles and Practice of Oncology. It matches our text. And what we're doing is combining the journal and the book so that the journal will be used to update the book periodically. Every issue will have updates of sections of the book to keep people abreast of the science. And we're like everybody else, we're looking at online versions of the book and ways to get information to people through all the various devices that are carried by doctors and in training and not in training.
I think it's fair to say that Dr. DeVita's book really is viewed as the Bible mm-hmm. of oncology yeah. and really is a must for everyone in the field to have.
Well, thank you, Ed. I've enjoyed it. It's great to see the book everywhere I go. When I go someplace, I look on the shelf and there's the book. It's really kind of fun.
Now, another interesting project I know you're working on with working with your daughter is on your memoirs and kind of looking at the historical perspective yeah. of this war on cancer. Yeah, how's that coming along?
My daughter is a writer. She has written a book herself. It's coming along quite well, actually. It should be about a year or so before we're finished. But I happened to be in the right place at the right time. I took care of the person who actually wrote the Cancer Act, and his response to cancer treatment was really what stimulated Mary Lasker to look at what we were doing. So I was there watching it being written. I was a skeptic like everybody else, and then I ran a big piece of the program, and then I ran the entire program, and then I came out and watched it by running a couple of cancer centers. So I have an unusual perspective of what happened and knew all the people there and what was going on behind the scenes. And this book is for lay people because I think that we've spent over $60 billion of money on the war on cancer, and I think the lay public who paid for it has a right to hear how it happened and why it happened and what it's done, and from somebody who, because he was in the right place at the right time, actually can say this actually happened this way as opposed to assuming something happened. I think a lot of critics of the program, bless their hearts, it's a massive program. It's very hard for anybody to start anew and get their arms around it. So I have a little different perspective. I'm having a lot of fun. If you had a 3 or 4 more hours on your show, I could regale you with all the stories that are floating around in my head. But my daughter is the one that gets the brunt of that at the moment. So.
I'll bring up a word that we don't use often, which is cure. Yeah. And it's nice to hear it on this show. But, what does the future hold in terms of the chance of curing people with cancer?
Well, we cure the great majority of patients right now with cancer. The problem is you don't see them, okay? And that's the way we want it. I mean, somebody who's had colon cancer and has got surgery and adjuvant chemotherapy and is perfectly normal and you see him, you never know they had colon cancer. What you see and what the public sees is a patient who's failing. And they think they translate that to everybody who has cancer, and it scares them, and it's not a real picture of it. But, you know, by the year 2000, mortality rates had dropped about 10%. And the Cancer Society has set a goal for a reduction in mortality by 50% by the year 2015. They have just recently projected as to where they are. And if not another thing happens from those projections, and by the way, a number of things have happened since they made those projections, then the mortality rates by 2015 will drop by 23.8%. But just factor in what we know has happened since they made those the estimates, they're probably closer to 30-35% reduction in mortality by 2015. And it's not impossible to hit 50% reduction. They are actually, for some tumors, they're going to be beyond the 50% goal they predicted. Like colorectal cancer, mortality rates are falling very fast. And even breast cancer seems in line with getting a 50% reduction by the year 2015. So we are doing well, but you have cancer and or somebody in your family has it and you're not doing very well, you're not doing well enough for those people. So I think there's the problem we face in the public perception of this.
I'd like to thank Dr. Vince DeVita for joining us on Yale Cancer Center Answers.
Vince, thanks so much for being with us this evening.
Great pleasure.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you and to get your perspectives on the state of cancer research. Until next week, this is Dr. Ed Chu.
Dr. Ken Miller.
From the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions, comments, or would like to subscribe to our podcast, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find transcripts of past broadcasts in written form. Next week, we examine new developments in the prevention and treatment of lung cancer.